Hello, everyone. Those of you tuning in for our guest today will know exactly where that came from. This is the QTR Podcast. Today is March 10th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me. Let me shout out some of my patrons. They're the people that make this podcast possible. If you enjoy the podcast, I love having you as a monthly recurring donor on my Patreon. I appreciate it very much. Gonna shout out some of my patrons, then we're gonna get on with the damn show. First and foremost, I want to thank my friends over at The Trader's Path for continuing to be patrons and active supporters of the podcast. Who are the people at The Trader's Path? Run by my brother Pete Hegedus, The Trader's Path is a brand new day trading and investing service. If you're a day trader and you're looking for a community to join of day traders, he has a brand new community that he just started up. He started it up because he got tired of the nonsense and the bullshit of other day trading services and said, you know what? Just like the Q man did, I'm gonna start my own shit because I don't like the way things are going. So Pete's been up and running for like a year now. He's got a great little group of people he's been telling me. He offers daily watch lists. He offers investor education, live streams. So he's gonna tell you what he's looking at on a daily basis as it's happening. He trades in red markets. He trades in green markets. He trades options. He trades everything basically except for low float nonsense bullshit that you're going to get at a lot of other trading services. So he avoids the nonsense. He's an honest guy, comes by his service honestly. And right now with the market in turmoil, it's a great time to have a community around you, people that you can bounce ideas off of and vice versa. So check out my man Pete over at The Trader's Path. There's a link to him in the podcast description. You can also follow him on Twitter. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. Folks, if you're looking for an edge on the market, this is a great place to do it. The Sang Lucci Steam Room gives you up-to-date, real-time information on money coming into the options market. Why is that important? Well, look, Lucci's been doing this for a decade. It's important because many times big moves come into the options market and that can oftentimes precede moves in the equities market. It's a little bit tougher to see when you're looking at stocks because the markets are so liquid. But in the options market, when a big player steps in and starts to swing his big dong in one direction or the other, you can actually see where the money is coming in and that can give you an edge as to where an equity may be going. Oftentimes, people know things, folks. It's a scummy world out there in the land of finance, but you can do it legitimately and legally by just watching where the money is going and then maybe betting accordingly. My friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room have it mastered. They've been doing it for a decade. They are also honest and wonderful people. They are dear friends of mine. In addition to the Steam Room, they offer the 3LT playbook, which is Lucci's three rules that he used to become a seven-figure trader, and they offer What do they offer? Oh yeah, the Sang Lucci Master Course. How could I forget? So if you want to take maybe some of that investor education you get at the Trader's Path, kick it up a little bit more, get another perspective, check out the Sang Lucci Master Course, or at least just follow him on Twitter too. Everything's free to follow the guys on Twitter. Those links are in my podcast description. If you're looking for another name to follow on Twitter, my friends at Rumorhound is a great name to have on Twitter. It's at Rumorhound. It is free, and I do encourage you to put them on mobile alerts. Why? Because Rumorhound, their Twitter account, is going to keep you up to date with merger and acquisition rumors all day, every day. So it's like having a live chat if you put them on push alerts. They're a great follow on Twitter. Who are they? Well, they also have a service called Rumorhound. And Rumorhound is brand new and it's proprietary. They use a set of variables and algorithms. It's artificial intelligence based. Bunch of shit that I don't understand, but I've used the platform. It's beautiful. It works. What do? They take a look at the merger and acquisition rumors that you see on a daily basis, whether they're in chat rooms, on CNBC, anywhere, and they plug it into their proprietary algorithm that is going to look at a bunch of different variables in the span of probably one millionth of a nanosecond, much faster than it takes you to, you know, sit around and scratch your ass and try to figure it out yourself. And it immediately spits back to you a recommendation as to how credible a rumor of a merger and acquisition might be. If you've been in the market for a while, or maybe even just for 5 minutes, you know that money can be made and lost on merger and acquisition rumors if you get ahead of the curve. Either way, sometimes you can make some coin on it. So my friends at Rumorhound offer a great product that you can add to your toolbox if you are a day trader Love him. Love Sanlucci. Love Pete over at the Trader's Path. Check him out. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer. If you're into shipping, check out my man Jay, Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground, Ken R., Chris Boas, Crichton Titus, Dylan Davis, Ken, J.K. Cunningham, and Stank Love. And also, how about some of my newest patrons, and then we're going to get started. People that have joined me recently that I appreciate. Kurt Woodcock, what's going on, brother? Thank you. Just emailed you yesterday. Had a nice conversation with you. David Hansen, I see Durabilis. You stuck with me, which I appreciate. Sean Wieland and Leonard Ruggiero, thank you so much. Greg Buchholz, I see Jim Tilton is still in the house. I appreciate you, Jim, very much. Adam Wise, Dylan Davis, Olga, my man Santo P is still with me. He's been with me for a while, which I appreciate. Man, he was an original. Santo's been down since August of 2018. Thank you, brother. Matt Marsh, D's Nuts. Some people that have been with me for a while. John Corcoran, my friend Carson, Ben Roy, Mason Bustle, Paul Brennan, and TJ. All right, let's get this fucking thing started. I am so stoked today. This is like a dream interview. If you have never listened to the podcast before, all you need to know is this is not financial advice. It's not life advice. And today, from me, it sure as hell isn't chess advice. But you may want to listen to the guy I got on the line because he's a real one in the world of chess and one of my absolute favorites. This podcast also has a two-drink minimum. Let that be known. Pound the drink and let's get started. On the line with me today is, if you play chess, this person has basically reached legendary status on YouTube. I can't believe he's not more all over the place than he is. I tried to find some interviews and stuff with this gentleman I have on today, and I wasn't able to find anything at all. And I was like, you know what? I got to get this dude on the podcast. I have the world famous Agadmator. Did I say that right, sir? Is it Agadmator?
Yeah, it's not at all like that. It's Agadmator.
Agadmator, okay. I have the world-famous Agadmator on with me today. Do you mind if I call you by your real name as well? Can I introduce you by your real name as well?
Yeah, of course. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Okay, so it's Antonio Radic, is that correct?
But yeah, Antonio Radic.
Antonio Radic, okay. So Mr. Antonio Radic runs Agadmator's chess channel, which has, I think, over 500,000 subscribers now at this point. Over 566,000 subscribers at this point. For those on a personal note, I started playing chess about 2 years ago, just started learning on my own. And as I was starting to pick it up, I went through various YouTube channels to try to just dip my hand in some analysis and learn some of the very basics. And Mr. Agadmator's channel is one of the first ones I came across. And if you search for chess on YouTube, you can't avoid it. It is the most ubiquitous and probably the most visited chess channel on YouTube. What he does is he provides wonderful analysis of games that have already been played, current games that are being played, recent ones, as well as games from years past. And he has a fantastic setup where he puts the board up on the channel and he goes along and analyzes a chess game as it's being played. He's obviously an extraordinary chess talent as well, but his channel has just grown in such popularity, and it's very easy to know why, because it's very easy to listen to. The analysis is simple to understand if you're a beginner. It's in depth if you're an advanced player. It leaves you spots where, he allows you to try to figure things out on your own. And it's just really a joy to watch. I watch at least one video every day. So welcome to the podcast, sir. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, I know that was a long-winded introduction, and I apologize about that. But how about your YouTube channel, man? How did this whole thing start with you and your YouTube channel, and how did it get so extraordinarily popular?
Well, it definitely is a question I'm asked a lot, and there's not much I can say on this, but I have dwelled on it for a while. But before I answer that, I would just like to answer your question that you didn't actually ask me, but you kind of did. you said that you searched online and tried to find some interviews with me, and there weren't any. Well, the truth is I actually decline pretty much every interview opportunity I get, because when I was starting out, but maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, I did do some interviews, and I really didn't like how they were presented, because everyone always tries to present the absolute least important thing I talk about. And I really didn't enjoy that. So lately, whoever asks me for an interview, I just decline it, because no one presents it in a way that I wish they would.
Well, we didn't talk about any of that beforehand. I mean, what's the most important thing for you, and what's the least important thing for you? What are people harping on that you wish they wouldn't?
Basically, they cannot believe someone. Someone makes money on presenting chess games other people played, and mostly what my channel and what I'm all about is that I want to promote the game of chess, the beauty of chess. I want to invite and show it to as many people as possible, and I don't know, it somehow gets lost in the interview, and that's mostly the reason why I decline all of them.
Well, I mean, just on a personal note, I can tell you right off the bat that, you know, your channel, before I got interested in learning about you personally, your channel has helped me immensely over the last 2 years. I watched two things, and I'm a very beginner player. I'm a novice, but I've watched the Garry Kasparov Masterclass probably about 100 times. Because okay. It's very long. And I watch at least two or three videos on your channel every night. And what I get from both of them, what's similar, is you both really love the game. I can tell by the way that you speak about it on your channel.
Yeah, that's almost an understatement, at least for me, because I really, really love the game. Like if only I've read as many books on actually playing chess as much as I did on the players who played it, you know, the great players of the past, and people who I really admire. I've read their autobiographies. I read a lot of things about them, but never so much about how to actually play the game. So it's more about the overall experience that chess provides to like yourself. Maybe you call yourself a novice, but to everyone, to an intermediate player, to an experienced player, maybe not so much to a professional, but I in chess, I don't really think you could even be a professional if you didn't really enjoy the game, because if you're all about the result, I don't know. It's hard to imagine that it would work out.
Well, yeah, it very much reminds me of jiu-jitsu in that regard, which is you just can't be afraid to lose. You can't be afraid to... I mean, you want to be competitive once you understand it, but you know, you have to understand, I think, that a lot of the feel for it comes just by... I mean, how many games do you feel like you've played over the course of your lifetime? Anybody ever ask you that? Could you guess?
No one ever asked me that, but I'm pretty sure it's around maybe 100,000, maybe 100 to 200,000. It's around that number.
And do you find that, you know, when you're talking to beginners about chess, is that type of, you know, is the most important thing to you to just get out there and just play and just get a feel for it and just, you know, repetition? Is that, you find that to be important?
Well, no, I mostly play for fun. It's not that I'm not going to play a blitz game, maybe a 3 minute or a 5 minute blitz game, and then analyze it afterwards and then learn something from it and then repeat the process like maybe 100 times, and then over the course of a week I'm gonna really advance in some way, or if I'm practicing an opening or in some way. But Most of those games are basically bullet games and really, really short blitz games, which are basically just for fun. Either I'm mostly using two PC screens. I would either watch a movie or some TV show or even play a game of Hearthstone or maybe something like that. And I'm going to play maybe a game on the other screen while enjoying both of those simultaneously. But it's not necessarily a learning process. But yeah, it's definitely important to get out there and just play some games, because if you just learn about it, if you just study theory without actually experiencing it, without experiencing someone else trying a different style, a different opening, a different approach, you're not really gonna understand anything.
When you commented before about reading the autobiographies of chess players, this is going to sound like a silly question, but do you find yourself just as interested in the personalities behind the game as you do the game itself, or maybe even more? I mean, how much more interested are you in the famous chess players and chess players that you know and love of days past versus the game itself?
Well, for me, I'm definitely, I enjoyed the game immensely, but I can remember when I started playing chess, and then at some point I started reading some books my grandfather gave me, and they didn't have a lot of famous chess players in there, I mean, regarding autobiographies, but I did get one about Bobby Fischer, and I did learn something about other players as well. And when I started reading them, when I learned about the great Mikhail Tal, when I learned about really, really important players of chess history, it was beyond inspirational. And I really thought, I wasn't young. I mean, chess players really start young today. I started maybe when I was 16 to play some chess, and then I started reading some books maybe at 17, 18. But I was extremely inspired, and I remember in my first tournament games, my first classical games, when I sat opposite of a very strong opponent, for example, after learning about Tal, I really tried to emulate his style and play like him, but it's, it would be an understatement to say that it's easier said than done, because it's incredibly difficult. And even without learning all that much theory, I basically propelled fairly quickly to a rating of maybe 2,000. And at that point, I kind of stopped. I went to college. I didn't dwell on chess all that much. Up until that point, I really used only the principles I've learned in books. And, I can pretty much say that a lot of games that I won by being inspired by the great players of the past, and not so much with the knowledge that I got from learning, for example, openings or maybe even end games.
Yeah, well, going right to a rating of 2,000, which is an absolutely exceptional rating. How much of that did you feel was book work, you know, like memorizing openings and learning end games and things like that? And how much of it do you attribute to kind of having a natural feel for the game also too? I mean, just what about your style of play in general?
Well, for me personally, whenever I play a game, I go out really bad in the openings. Like I always joke. I mean, I often joke about it with my with members from my team club. I say, if only I had your position after the opening, then I would play exceptionally. But I always have my position after the opening, and I always like, if you put it to a computer evaluation, it's always a -2. But it's a complicated position. It's, and I feel very comfortable in those positions, so I enjoy playing positions like that. Most of it, it's that I really enjoy it, but. Not just you said like it's enjoying the game. It's more of a enjoying the psychology of the game, enjoying the fact that I know that my opponent will not be able to play the absolute best move for every move. Enjoying the I may be down a pawn now, but I'm well prepared now to play this game for 3 or 4 more hours, where I will maybe equalize in 2 hours, and then I will fight it on. And some people, for example, lack that kind of a discipline. But now it's only been maybe lately that I've started going into some openings and and some systems that I was able to break 2100, and now I feel fairly comfortable in the opening stages of the game. But I don't play any tournaments other than the ones maybe local ones, and something that I don't have to devote much time to, as I'm quite busy with the channel and a lot of things that I'm doing at the moment. But I do feel that maybe in a year or so I might start going to some open tournaments to see if I can again try to be a tournament player.
Yeah, well, congratulations. I mean, that's an exceptional rating, so congratulations on breaching the 2100 mark. And do you find that, you know, so I guess what you're telling me is you kind of put yourself in defensive positions on purpose. Is that what you're saying? You kind of like that? You can stay calm in those types of positions if you get down a piece? And you kind of, you know, you feel like you have a psychological advantage in those situations?
Well, not so much psychological advantage, but I feel comfortable in any position because I really enjoy chess and I enjoy playing it, and I enjoy even the fact that my opponent is currently better, but I enjoy experiencing how he will take advantage of that. And if he doesn't, then I wanna have a say in it.
Do you prefer to play against higher rated players? Does it not matter to you? I mean, do you like playing with beginners as well?
Well, if it's a casual game, if it's an unrated game, I always enjoy playing against everyone. But if it's a tournament game, of course, I prefer playing against higher rated players, as does anyone. Because if you win, of course, the reward is much higher. you feel better about yourself, about your accomplishment. You gain more rating points. And if you play against a lower rated opponent, it's expected of you to win. So it's not... the game can be just as great, but it's not maybe on a personal level, maybe not considered such an accomplishment.
Yeah, if you're speaking to a beginner player or somebody that hasn't played before, because a lot of people that listen to my podcast, a lot of my listeners, I know some of them do play chess, some of them don't, because we have different crowds that we speak to. But if you're speaking to a beginner player, what do you kind of recommend is the best way to start from zero? What types of games, what style of games, and how would you kind of go about introducing yourself to the game for the first time?
Well, do you mean like absolute zero, like someone who doesn't know
somebody that's never played chess before and maybe just knows, just knows how the pieces move, barely?
Okay, that's not absolute zero. That's a lot.
Okay.
If someone knows how the pieces move, then that person is already capable of enjoying the game. That's that's a whole other level. I've actually never met anyone who doesn't know how the pieces move.
Oh, like, I have.
Okay. I mean, everyone knows the knight goes in the L shape. I don't know if there are people who don't know that. I'm sure they do, but...
Well, you'll have to come to my local bar sometime if you're ever in the United States.
gladly. But to someone who knows how the pieces move, they just have to go out there and play a game. They have to, go to any chess client online, chess.com, chess24, Elite Chess, and play at least 20 games and see where they stand, and then grab any piece of learning material if they would like to get better. But whatever you take on, if you open a YouTube video, I myself prefer books. If you grab a book on openings, on basic chess principles, on endings, on maybe middle games where you have to find a plan how to continue the game where it's not all that clear, I find that players of the past who wrote books really explained it well, especially for beginners.
Okay.
Because nowadays. That's why I myself don't make videos on openings or maybe on basic ideas,
right?
Because I feel there's so much material on it everywhere that I just don't have anything to contribute to the table.
So, what is your process when you're going to analyze a game? I watch these videos that are very professionally done and beautifully done. And as a content creator myself, I understand that you're actually putting in an exceptional amount of work. So I was sorry to hear that people that have interviewed you are, you know, focusing on the money aspect and those things. First off, you deserve everything you make. I don't think people really understand how much work it is to be a content creator in general, but specifically when you're sitting there and you're trying to pack all this information. Okay, you're doing 1, 2, 3 derivatives off of almost every single move in a chess match, and you're cramming it all into 6 minutes or 7 minutes. What's your process like for preparing your analysis and your video and then going ahead with it?
Well, first thing I do is, of course, I decide on a chess game I'm going to show. Mostly, I definitely try to make it a really interesting game, a game where something really spectacular happens, and of course, people really enjoy that. But for example, at the moment, I'm making the Paul Morphy saga on the great Paul Charles Morphy, and I might show a game or two that's not all that spectacular because I really need it for the story. And how I go about it is. Definitely have a book or two that I use for references, and I tend to read it so I know the backgrounds of the tournaments of the players themselves, and that's something I enjoy the most. Then I go through the game and I just look at it, and then I'm like, okay, that's a nice game. Maybe some of the moves are pretty weird, and try to make a story. I mean, I try to already in my head make a video while I'm replaying the game in my head. And then, of course, when there are some crazy tactical lines, when there's a lot of things happening at the board, I run it through a chess engine. And then, of course, if I didn't use a chess engine, I would make too many mistakes and it would take too long to make a video. So the engine, of course, tells me, okay, if this, then this is the reply. And then at that moment when the engine says this is why this is bad, then, of course, you understand it. But if you had to come up with it yourself, it would take you, somewhere between 5 minutes and never to find the answer yourself.
Right.
So, I mean, that's inevitable in trying to cram so much material in, let's say, a 10-minute video. And then when I understand the game, when I find that sweet spot of the game, that move where the game swindled, or maybe there are a couple of such instances in the game,
right.
Then I decide how to present that game as a story, so it would be interesting to everyone. But I try to do it so it would be interesting to me, because that's how I see the game. And It does take some time, but it's not nothing, you know, crazy. I mean, for maybe a 40 move game, it would require me maybe 2 hours of preparation to make it. So it's not that crazy, but sometimes I will do maybe 4 videos a day, and then it could consume my whole day. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and people that people that give you the business about making money or whatever, they want to focus on that end of the spectrum. I mean, I think the problem is that I watch your videos as a content creator, and not only do you, you know, perform wonderful analysis of the game, but you also have, you know, you have your donors listed on your screen. You have a nice little split screen there so that, you know, people can see you and people can see the board. Oftentimes, when you are analyzing a match from a certain tournament, you know, you provide photographs and things like that. So, you know, I can tell that it takes you some time to put the things together. And, you know, I just, on behalf of myself and definitely the rest of your viewers, I just want to let you know how much we appreciate that. And I think I probably speak for all of us when I say that we're very happy that you're finding such success, because it really is, it's really a wonderful thing, your channel. It really is nice.
Yeah, well, thank you, but that's what I often like to tell people. It's not, I don't do it so it would reach success or induce such a feeling in people, but I always say that I feel a certain way about a lot of things the way that I do. And the world is a big place, and if there are people who feel the same way about it, then those are the people that will enjoy my channel. And I mean, to me, it's sheer luck that so many people enjoy it the way I enjoy it, basically.
Yeah, I feel the I know exactly how you feel. I'll just say that. And so I want to ask you just a couple more questions. You've played Magnus Carlsen a couple of times, I've seen.
No, I've never played Magnus. I only played once where it was a game of hand and brain, and Magnus was making the moves, but another person was saying the moves.
Oh, okay, so okay.
It's a bit different.
Ah, okay. So that was the video I watched where there were two people.
Yeah.
So you weren't actually playing Magnus.
No, because when you play hand and brain, one person can say, okay, I pawn, and then Magnus chooses which pawn goes where.
Oh.
Yeah, if he says knight, that knight goes, whichever knight Magnus chooses goes to a square Magnus chooses, for example.
Well, I'm such a novice, I didn't even know that. I apologize. But he seemed, Magnus obviously knows exactly who you are. I think he referred to you as the, you know, the great... Agad Mator before that match started. That had to be pretty cool.
Yeah, that was very cool. And also he said some nice things about me a few days ago on his on a stream of his Overspiel chess club from Norway, but in Norwegian. So I didn't share it. But some of the people that understand Norwegian translated it to me. And suffice it to say, they were very nice things.
And I'm sure, I'm sure you'll get your chance to play him eventually if you'd like. It just feels like the natural order of things that will happen at some point. You know, a funny story is some years back, I think it was 2014, before I had even started introducing myself to the game of chess, I was at an investing conference in New York City called the Sohn Investment Conference. And Magnus was one of the guests. He was the guest of honor, I think, that came on at, 5 o'clock in the afternoon that day. And
okay.
He sat on the stage. There's a video of this on YouTube where he sits on the stage and he's playing, I think, like 7 or 8 different opponents blindfolded, at
once. I think it was 10. I think
was
it was
10? 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so... as I started to go back and, to be honest with you, I didn't really even know who Magnus Carlsen was, So as I'm learning the game from the ground up and, watching his history and some of the documentaries and things that have been made about him. And I find this video and I was like, oh, my God, I was there and I didn't even go in and see it. I was so upset with myself.
Yeah, that's actually very impressive. It's been done a lot of times, and I think the world record actually in blindfold games is I could be wrong, but I think last time I checked it was maybe either 48 or 52 games. Oof. Blindfold. I think it was Timur Gareev, Grandmaster. So I don't know if that record was broken, but that's the last information I remember.
This might sound like a dumb question. You'll have to forgive the rudimentary nature of my questions. Again, I'm a novice, but... when you're playing 10 chess matches at the same time and you're blindfolded, and I don't know if you've ever done anything like this or not, is how much of that is just pure talent, do you think, and how much of it is knowing and understanding the game and the boundaries of the game as it's being played, like all of the different possibilities versus just having, something special in your psyche that allows you to do it?
Well, I've never tried playing more than one blindfold game, and I am capable of playing a blindfold game. For example, if I play against a weaker opponent, I don't really mind playing a blindfold game. It's I wouldn't say it's exactly the same as playing with actual view of the board, but I do okay. I don't miss anything. But the problem is, I know most of the things that happen. I very quickly gain either an advantage in the opening or I get a position that I'm comfortable with, so it's not a problem tending to it blindfold. But if I played 2 or 3, I don't know if I would be able to recollect where the pieces were, because sometimes when I'm playing one game and I don't know, it takes my opponent some time to make a move, then I have to remember where the pieces are. I have to replay the game from the start to put the pieces on their correct squares. So it's I don't think it's a talent. I think it's an acquired technique. Because as a chess player, you are constantly looking at diagrams, either right. solving them or using the 2D board, maybe playing on your computer. But the more you do this, the more you have the board in your head. Because when you right. play blindfold chess, the board in your head is not a 3D board. It's a 2D board. It's a diagram, at least for me. So you don't know where, for example, when you play 50 of them, I don't think you know exactly which board is board 28, but you can very quickly replay the moves in your head and you know, okay, here I use this opening, here I use this opening, here I use this opening, and then you can sort of get the position in your head. But how exactly is it done on such a massive scale, I have no idea.
Yeah, and it's interesting. One of the things that you just mentioned is one of the difficulties that, you know, I've had as a novice player, which is transitioning from playing on the phone or playing on the computer, which is where I play a majority of my matches, to playing in person. And it's very different. It's a different view of the board when you're looking at the board in 3D versus looking at a screen in 2D. It's a very different experience. So much so that I had to get a chess set for Christmas this year because I didn't want to learn in 2D and then sit down to play a match with somebody and not know how to look at the board. I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like there is a profound difference there, or do you think maybe that's just because I'm a novice?
Well, I think, for example, me and people who started with a 3D board, not with a digital board, it's much easier because I know players that didn't even touch chess in real life, and they just maybe played on their phone or on their computer. And when they're presented with an actual 3D board where they have to, you know, pick up the piece, put the piece down, hit the clock, it's too much. For example, we had one player. He joined our chess club and immediately joined our Blitz tournament a week ago. And although he plays a lot on Lee Chess, and he's around, I think, 1800, maybe 1850, in real life, picking up the pieces and combining it with the clock and with controlling the entire game was a bit overwhelming. So I think it's easier for people who started with a just a normal board and then went online than when you start online and then you have to transpose. But yeah, I don't think it's a long process. I think maybe a week or two and you're good to go.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the points that you just made reminded me of one of my favorite pieces of analysis that you did. Which was the Maurice Ashley versus Wilson the Hustler in the park.
And
I had seen that video of Maurice Ashley, the Grandmaster, playing the Hustler in the park. I think they're in New York City, right? I had seen that prior to you analyzing it. And when I found your analysis, I was like, oh, this is awesome. I'm not the only person that's seen this, you know, YouTube video. And it was really awesome to get a look at the board as that was happening. But the thing that reminded me of that just now was as soon as Maurice Ashley sits down and the way he holds, you know, the way he moves his pawn, the way he adjusts the clock, the way he sits there, you know, the calmness that he has when he goes to open the game, the hustler who's playing in the park immediately says, oh, you're an expert, right?
Yeah, because you exert a certain strength. I mean, when you sit, the stronger the player, the stronger you, let's say, move the pawns, and the stronger you just sit at the board. I mean, it's just something you can tell when someone sits at the board. Is he a good player or not?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that analysis. I mean, you don't need to recall the game, obviously, or the entire match, whatever the proper term is. I'm sorry. You don't have to recall the whole thing. But if you could just describe it maybe to the listeners, because I think it would be an interesting one for people to check out that haven't really looked at any of your videos yet. There's an en passant move in there, and then you have the hustler as well. If you could talk about your analysis of that.
Yeah, as far as I recall, the opening was pretty okay. I mean, Wilson the Hustler did follow basic chess principles. He started developing pieces, but then at some point, I think maybe around even move 5 or 6, you could already see the difference in skill between Maurice and him. And at some point, like you've mentioned, there was even a case where Wilson the Hustler tried to grab 2 pieces with one knight, and it was it was the greatest move the chess world has ever seen, but of course Maurice caught it, and he requested that the additional piece be put back to the board. And of course, when the game continued, there wasn't all that much for poor Wilson to do. But he did try, and then at the end, when of course Maurice presented himself as a grandmaster, then Wilson was out of his mind. He was like, "Oh no, I play the grandmaster! No, turn off the camera! No, don't!" But it was it was just great.
When Maurice first sat down and Wilson started talking throughout that entire match, I mean, that's something that hustlers do on purpose, right? They just talk constantly through the match to try to distract who they're playing. Is that, or was he just a talkative person?
No, I think that's something they enjoy doing, and that it's something that maybe throws off a weaker opponent. As I've never actually played a hustler myself. We don't really have them here in Croatia. If I ever visit New York or maybe Washington, where there are known chess hustlers, I'm definitely going to check it out. But I think it's something to throw off weaker opponents and maybe get them to think something is happening that is not. Because in general, the chess hustlers don't have exactly formal chess education. They have street chess skills, which is mostly tactics and mostly dirty tricks. maybe not all of them, but that's how they're portrayed. Like I said, I've never played any of them, but that's how they are usually portrayed. And then, of course, if even a stronger player doesn't have to be a grandmaster, knows some additional principles which don't allow such positions to arise, I don't think that they would have much chance against such a player.
I think you would probably have some interesting experiences, especially given the fact that you just told me you like to kind of open your games in a weak position, you know, with you could.
No, I don't like it. It just happens.
Oh, you! I thought you were saying you did it on purpose.
No, I mean I try to be creative and everything, but it's like I always end up in a suspicious position, then I have to wiggle out of my way out of that one.
I thought maybe you could go and hustle some hustlers, you know, make them think they're winning, and then before bludgeoning them to death.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know how strong they are, and I hope that I would be able to match their skill, but who knows? They could be exceptionally strong. You never know.
So I just have a couple of more questions, and I appreciate you being very generous with your time today. You know, when I first started looking at the game of chess, one of the things that I wanted to figure out before I threw myself at it and before I took the time to try to learn it, you know, little by little, bit by bit.
Okay.
For me, mentally, one of the things that I wanted to know was that given the nature of the game and the nature of the way that the pieces move, that there's essentially an infinite number of combinations of different games. I felt like, and now as I learn a little bit more, you know, you learn about popular lines, popular openings, things like that. But the one thing that I wanted to kind of make sure of was that there was still, I mean, of course, there's been, you know, probably billions of chess games played throughout the course of eternity and millions or billions documented. But I wanted to make sure that there was still that little room for, you know, a spark of creativity, and that not all moves, you know, are always going to be known by even the strongest players, and not all positions are always going to be known by the strongest players. That little room there for creativity is something that really draws me to learning. I mean, I'll never even get close to it, but I want to know it's there. Do you think about things like that?
Well, I not only think about things like that, I confront them on a daily basis. It's a very interesting question. For example, at the absolute highest level, for example, in the candidates tournament, in the World Chess Championship match, in some of the top tier events, for example, in the Grand Chess or in the Tata Steel Chess, in Grenke Chess Classic, you will not have so many opportunities to show your creativity because most of the lines these top players play are, all the lines all players play are prior prepared, but here they are prepared to such a detail that you will simply not have, you will not have the opportunity to show your creativity because if you think like there's something there, there's actually not. Because your opponent knows this position and he knows there's no spectacular reply or that something incredible can happen.
Right.
But if you go to an open tournament, for example, where it's not an invitational with 12 of maybe the top 20 players of the world, a Grenke Chess Classic is a good example. I think they'll have like maybe 1,500 people playing there. Then anyone can face anyone, and at that level, for example, even a top elite player, when he faces a 200 rating lower rated opponent, when that player has nothing to lose, but if he wins, you know, he can be, you know, the champion of the world, he can become famous, then anything can happen in such a game, and maybe the top elite player will face maybe a system that he's not all that familiar with, and maybe we're going to have a very interesting position already as of move 8 or maybe 12, and then things can happen and it can get very interesting and creative. But in absolute elite chess, not so much.
How important to you is the ability to be creative?
Well, it's the only important thing, because at some point you will have to show your creativity, even if it's an endgame creativity with only a few pieces and pawns on the board. But that's something that really inspires and that gets people into chess, because no one, you're not going to impress your friend who never even thought about playing chess by showing him a boring game where nothing really happened, and by maybe moving pieces. But if you say to him as a story, and if he knows just enough to realize how ridiculous and crazy the game you've just shown him is, then that could be enough to make him a chess player for his entire life.
Yeah, and I think it's that kind of spark of, like you said, that provides inspiration. I think you're, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm just doing this from memory, but I think one of your most popular videos, if not your most popular one, is about a queen sacrifice. And often, you know, as I'm watching your videos, there is this spot, even for a novice player, you know, and you do a wonderful job of explaining it, which helps a lot, but there's often a spot where, you know, the ones that draw you in the most are, hey, you know, this guy traditionally would do this or is supposed to make this move, but he kind of veers off the path here. Sometimes it happens by accident. People get, you know, jammed up in a position they don't want to be in. Other times it happens on purpose. And, you know, I think the reason that people are drawn to videos like that, I mean, I really feel like that's where some real magic from the game comes from. You know, do you feel the same way?
Again, it's the same, like I said in the beginning. I just present it as I enjoy it, and that's the people that enjoy it the way that I do enjoy my videos. And the game you mentioned, Rashid Nejmedinov versus Oleg Chernikov, 1962 Soviet Team Championship. That queen sacrifice, I remember the first time I saw it. I saw it in a documentary by Jessica Fischer. And when I saw it in that video, when I saw queen captures on f6, I didn't fell out of my chair, but I almost did, and I wanted to call all my chess friends and tell them about this spectacular move. It was just it was just nothing like nothing I've ever seen. It's not a correct sacrifice. It's not positionally sound. It's not even good. But psychologically and the way the game continued, to me it's the masterpiece. Like not a masterpiece, the masterpiece. And after that game, that was the first time I even heard of Rashid Nezhmetdinov. And after that, I started looking into him, and then I realized, okay, that's what chess is about. Not on the highest level, where you have to, of course, win games and you have to justify your score at the end of the tournament. But when you want to present chess as maybe an art and maybe a way to express yourself and maybe, you know, just a breath of fresh air when it's a really a boring tournament or something, that's what Rashid always brought to the table. And I remember I didn't have all that many people to show it to. And again, that's one of the reasons why I have my channel. At least that way more people can see it. And now that I think that over 4 million people saw my video on that game, that's okay. That's mission.
Yeah, I think some people have taken notice now, right?
Yeah, and at least, you know, they know who good old Rashid was.
So when you're doing an analysis and you are talking about just along the same lines of what we're talking about, and you say as of move 8 or as of move 9, you know, we're looking at an entirely new game. Is that based on the engines that you're using? I mean, obviously, it's a position maybe somebody has played at some point in history. But is it just, are you using a collection to compare it to? You know, as a novice, I don't understand what you use for reference there, and you'll have to forgive me.
Well, there are free databases online that you can reference the position. For example, you load your position in there, and then the database tells you if this position has been reached before or not, by which player, at what point, what tournament, what year. And I use a free database, and it may not be always be as correct. The reason I don't use a paid one, because the one that I use, you will usually tell me about top-tier tournaments and top-tier players that reach this position. But maybe if I pay for a database, it will tell me, okay, this position was reached even by below 2,000 players, maybe 50 more times. But for the purposes of the video, I don't think it's all that much important. So that's why I only use a free one.
Yeah, because you know, obviously now you have the best players in the world that are playing that position. So I have to say, when I hear that in a video of yours, and I hear you say, okay, well, as of move 8, you know, we have an entirely new position, my ears always perk up a little bit. You know, it's interesting. It feels like, you know, you're on the cusp of discovering something almost when you say, especially for a novice like me that, you know, I haven't seen, you know, thousands of games or hundreds of thousands of games. So or matches. I'm sorry if I'm using the wrong term. But for me, that always perks my ear up. Is that something that you look forward to as well when you're watching two expert players play? Does it draw your interest?
Definitely, because if you look at it, most of today's games will revolve around maybe a Queen's Gambit decline, maybe some Rui Lopez. Okay, we're going to see the Sicilian Nidorf, we're going to see Carlsen Svechnikov, we're going to see, I don't know, maybe a Grunfeld. But all of those positions have been reached thousands of times. And that one moment where I see that a new position has been reached and that one of the players prepared a fancy reply so the other player has to think about it, that's where the game really begins. Because I think there was a game not so long ago, I think it was Anish Giri versus Shakhtar Mamedyarov, where Mamedyarov played Unknown Theory for 21 move, and then on 22nd move where Giri prepared a move, I think it's about that he completely blundered and lost the game. Like it was the first move where he actually had to play a move that he comes up with that it's not known, right? And then the position completely collapses. So That's not the, that's not a prime example that I'm looking forward to. I don't really enjoy where someone was caught off guard, maybe with a preparation. I enjoy it when maybe it's a new move in a new position, and then both players start creating something. But it's always a special moment, definitely.
As you're advancing, you become a more advanced player. I mean, how important is it to learn the theory of all of these very well-known lines, like you're saying, and prepare for them versus just allowing yourself to sit and look at the board and, you know, try to feel out your next move or do it in your head? I mean, I'm nowhere near that level, so I don't really have an understanding. I mean, how important is it to know different theories to a degree of 20 moves or 25 moves like you're talking about, versus just having a feel for the game? And maybe do you have a player that best exemplifies each of the tactics?
Well, no. The game I mentioned, that's not for someone who just plays casually. That's if you're an absolute elite player, then okay, you can play chess on such a level. But if you're a beginner, if you're just starting out, then there's no point in you. For me, I don't think there's too much point of you learning openings. Okay, learn the names of the openings and learn maybe the first couple of moves so you understand what the opening is all about. And you know, find a system that works for you and stick with it. But most important for beginners is learn basic chess principles, which, you know, are abundant. You can go anywhere and look for them online in books. So basic chess principles, and those are basically the things that you can talk about with your friends. You can enjoy them, like, you know, grab the center of the board very early. Knights go into the game before bishops. You have to bring your king to safety. Don't bring your queen out too early. Maybe, develop your pieces as deep into the position as possible. Those are some basic chess principles, and there are a lot of them. And once you get a feel for them, it's much easier to play the game. And basically, all the openings arise from basic chess principles. They are basically just different weapons you bring to a fight. But then after you get a feel for the game and for the basic chess principles, then you wanna you kind of need to study the end game, and that's the most important part of chess. And for me, the most interesting one. And then maybe at some point when you get stronger, then you are allowed to study openings, because there are a lot of examples where teachers teach children openings, and then okay, they play a good opening, they're doing really well in the middle game, and then they just do nothing. So I don't know, to me that's definitely not the way to go. So for me, the way to start would be basic chess principles, then solving some diagrams. Of course, you have to solve puzzles, maybe 20 or 40 puzzles per breakfast. So you just get the feel of what's happening, and of course the end game. But then openings at a much later stage in your development.
How many games do you play a day? How many puzzles do you do a day?
Well, it really depends. I tend to play a lot of bullet games, as it's something I enjoy. It's okay, a lot of people will say it's not real chess, but it's very relaxing. Even hyperbullet, maybe 30-second games, they're very enjoyable. Maybe I will play 10 blitz games a day. And regarding puzzles, okay, nowadays I don't really do all that much puzzles, but when I was studying on my chess, I used to do a lot. I remember I always recommend this book, Strategy and Tactics. It's a really brilliant trilogy by Grigory Mikhailovich Lisitsyn, and it's a book in three parts, like I said, a trilogy, and it took me like maybe a year and a half to go through it. It was a great experience, and I feel it really helped my understanding of tactics. Because it doesn't help you if you know how to solve a position, but if you understand the patterns of the tactic, for example, from that position, then you might see that pattern 10 moves or maybe 5 moves before it actually happens. So you can maybe force it to happen, and that's also a big part of tactics.
Do you remember? Was there a certain point where you fell in love with the game, or did you always just enjoy it from the get-go? Was there a point where something clicked for you, or, you know, where you had some type of epiphany or revelation, or you just, you know, kind of fell face first in love with the game, or was it something that developed over time for you?
Well, if I had to pinpoint it, it would actually be a two-point pinpoint, so to say. I remember as my grandfather taught me to play chess maybe when I was 4 or 5 years old, I didn't play again a game until I was maybe 16. And I vividly remember it. My friend, we were drinking some, I don't know, some wine at some party or whatever it was. And he said that he could checkmate me in 7 moves. And although I didn't play chess, I knew that I knew the rules, and that there was no way that he can checkmate me in 7 moves. I can just I can just stall and do nothing, right, and he will not. And I even ended up winning that game. So I thought, wow. I mean, I haven't played for a very long time, and I was able to win that game. He wasn't a good player, don't get me wrong, but still, I was very impressed that I was actually able to win. And then that's basically the instance that got me playing again, because I thought, wow, if I haven't played for so long and I was able to win a game, then, and I really had a good time. So I started playing again, and then maybe it was a year or two, I think, after that incident, my sister's boyfriend, who was a chess player, he set up the position on the board. We were having coffee in some bar, and he asked me, can you solve it? And I was looking at it, and it just didn't make any sense, and I wasn't able to solve it. And he showed me the explanation, the solution to the puzzle, and it was the point was, you promote a pawn, but not to a queen, you promote it to a knight. And when I saw that, I was like, wow. And I even have a video about that moment. It's on my channel called the puzzle that made me fall in love with chess, I believe. And I showed that puzzle, and it's really, really just amazing. But yeah, if I had to pinpoint it, it was those two moments that got me back into chess.
That's wonderful. And, you know, that promoting your pawn to a knight is one of the little kind of dark alleys of magic in chess that, you know, when you sit down and you learn, you know, as a beginner, as a novice, you know, I think I've watched that video on your site, but, you know, obviously have learned to the point where why you would want to promote. And everybody thinks the queen is, you know, always the strongest piece on the board, but there are situations where if you do, you know, you promote to a knight, you know, you're guarding certain squares that you're not guarding with a queen, or you can reach certain positions that you can't. It's those little things that just really make me enjoy the game as well, and, you know, kind of discover new things. So that's really cool that you brought up that example. So listen, I want to, I just have one more question here for you. Okay. Maybe I have two, but we'll wrap things up here. I know you have things to do today, and I appreciate your time. I guess one of the things that I want to know is, what do you like outside the world of chess? I mean, for a year and a half, I've been sitting down watching videos of you with your dog kind of hanging out in the background, who is awesome and makes the videos always have a very nice, warm, homey feel to them. And, you know, after a while, I know many of your other viewers probably wonder too, like, what's this guy like outside the world of chess? What else do you enjoy? What else do you do?
Well, that's a big question. What I do enjoy, most of all, I enjoy meeting people, meeting new people. For example, I was a longtime member of the couchsurfing community. I didn't go to other places, but I invited a lot of people to stay at my place. So, for example, I don't know, in one summer, I had maybe 60 people from 60 different countries visit my visit my residence. And although you don't go anywhere, you don't travel, I learned a lot about other places. You get out of this mindset that the world is only where you live. Sure. You realize what a big place it is, different customs, different people. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoy, for example, good conversations with those people I meet. I enjoy reading about different ideas, different stuff. I enjoy good movies, TV shows. I enjoy some video games. I don't play them anymore all that much, but I do enjoy them as, I don't know. For example, I'm not gonna play a game if it comes out, but I'm gonna maybe watch cinematics of it on YouTube because I'm interested in the story. And I live for a long time with my girlfriend now, for maybe almost 10 years. So we're starting to build a house now. We're have a lot of things we have to get together. So I don't know. I'm pretty sure I'm missing a lot of things, but those are basically to maybe sum it up.
One of the things that I enjoy watching, you were talking about watching video games on YouTube and, you know, not even playing them. One of the things that I really enjoy too, and will often do before watching your channel, is I'll watch people speed run video games. Have you seen those videos?
Oh yeah, definitely. Just the other day I was explaining to my friend, well, they're basically a couple, that I watched this speed run of Super Mario Bros. That was so insane. He finished it in like 4 minutes and 50 seconds, and it just blew my mind. It was like, I thought maybe Alpha Zero couldn't do better. This is impossible.
Right.
And they didn't believe me that someone actually did that. And then I showed it to them, and they were, it blew their mind.
Yeah, to me, there's, I don't know what the analog is between that and chess, but the ability to kind of be able to play a game to a frame perfect degree and essentially get from the beginning of it to the end of it in the fastest and most efficient way possible. I find that exceptionally interesting, and I've kind of gotten addicted to watching that as well. So it's interesting that you find that interesting. My last question. I saw a photograph of you. I think it was on your Twitter, actually. I follow you on Twitter.
Okay.
You recently just won a first prize in a local tournament. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so congratulations for that as well. And the photograph is of you out at the pub. And you also mentioned to me before you had had some wine at one point when you were in your teens. And I ask a lot of my guests, you know, if we go out for a drink together, what are you most likely to order? What do you like?
Depends on why we're meeting. Like if we're meeting for coffee, I would most likely have coffee. if we're meeting for, let's say, if you and I now went out and we just started talking about something, I would most likely order a large beer. That would mostly be it. And then maybe after a few of them, maybe even something else. Who knows?
Do you have a beer preference or a liquor preference as well? Like what style of beer, what style of liquor?
Regarding beer, we have a really, really awesome homebrewed beer here in my hometown. It's called Križevačko Pivo, and it's simply the best beer. It's not available anywhere else, so if you want to try it, you have to come to my hometown. And as of maybe liquor, hard liquor, rakia all the way. So
what is that? I'm not sure what that is.
Oh, it's something maybe not indigenous to these areas, but I think it's hard liquor, maybe 40 to 45% alcohol, and you could get it from a lot of things, maybe from plum, from pear, from it's like vodka, only better. And now that you asked me about it, it's hard to explain. It's just great.
Yeah, well, you know what? We'll get together one of these days and we'll put a couple of back, and then we'll write a book about trying to describe what it tastes like.
Yeah, definitely. There's no other way around it.
Listen, my friend, if you're ever in the States, you're more than welcome. I'd love to buy you a drink any day of the week. But on behalf of everybody that watches your channel and people that have yet to fall in love with your channel, and there's going to be many more of them, and I almost feel like unworthy to thank you on behalf of all these people because I'm such a novice and I kind of just discovered your stuff a couple of years ago. I just want to say thank you so much and just let you know what an honor it is for you to have chosen to come on and speak with me. You said you're very selective with your interviews, and I really appreciate it. I genuinely appreciate it.
Yeah, well, when you first contacted me and I thought about should I do it, should I not, I just popped any of your podcasts and I enjoyed your style in the first 15, 20 seconds and I said, that's okay. I don't need to hear anymore. It's gonna be a good show.
Well, I did my little thing before I introduced you on this podcast, and I think you'll like how I started this one off as well. So, listen, my friend, thank you so much for being generous with your time, and really appreciate you coming on. All right.
Okay. Thank you, and to all of your viewers, don't be afraid to take up a game of chess. You might be surprised, where it will take you.
Awesome, fantastic, and please. Then go and check out your channel because it's a wonderful way to experience the game. All right, that was the one, the only Agad Mator, the man himself. I can't believe I got him on for an interview. I have, I get selfish with the podcast sometimes, and I just like to talk to people that I personally find interesting. And I know a lot of people probably expecting a finance podcast today or a coronavirus podcast today, but man, I'm really glad he was able to take time out of his day, and it's very cool to kind of put some more details to the name and the face that I see online. So I got plenty of stuff scheduled for this week. I want to one more time thank my patrons for making the podcast possible, and hope some of you chess community out there that maybe have never listened to the podcast before enjoyed this. And certainly I hope some of my listeners that are, finance-oriented people or political-oriented people, no better way to discover how awesome chess can be than to check out that gentleman's channel, and I will put it in the podcast description. I am out. Peace.